Mr. Cheeseman, Reel 41. We're talking about your memories of Italy.
Yes, this particular incident, the captain, how much hot lunch, what SMA is backwards in the half hour. Okay, my driver lifted the bonnet and got the tins of food and things like that. And we just about to get cracking with the tin opener. When we all fell at the same time, we dropped to the ground, revolvers out ready, and an old man came out from the rubble of the house, and of course, you know, he was frightened, so what is it? So I said, you know, are you hungry, Pops? And I left me sort of broad grin to do the translating. Anyway, he sort of brightened a little bit and grew in stature almost, and beckoned the rest of his family out of the rubble which had been obviously in the home. His wife, obviously, a great old lady, and his daughter, who had a daughter, this lass was about 3 years old. When we saw the little lass, of course, we said, hello, it is okay, we eased up a bit. And they were desperately hungry. So we give them their our hot meal, you know. And by the way, Becky and the little lass, the play with the dog, it was great, you know. Anyway, I would have liked to have communicated with them, but, you know, I couldn't. Now, back in Egypt, at one time, when we were down the Delta, we'd have to do odd jobs and what have you. One of the jobs was supplying a guard just for 24 hours, a battalion, to an Italian prisoner of war camp. And I was part of that. And I was trying to communicate with the prisoners on the side of the wire. And I happened, and by the way, I'm a classical music lover, you know. I happened to sort of, I don't know why, but I happened to whistle something called Verdi or something like that, you know. And immediately I got a response. And we started singing. And, you know, we don't need language for that sort of. And so I tried it with a folly. So I started singing Underneath the Arm, you know, the Lily Marlene, which is known by everybody out there. Oh my goodness me, we were, you know, I think Julie Andrews, the one track children, took a leaf out of our books, and that's when it's Leader came back. Anyway, he saw the losing side of it.
Where were you sleeping at the end of the day, at the side of the vehicle? Yeah.
And of course, we caught a cold on that line because we never used the water.
What was the weather like?
Back end, the heavy torrential rain, lovely sunshine, and at one time, huge hailstones actually brought blood out of some, the few times I've used it in that.
But were you bogged down? Were you able to move? Okay.
Difficult, but we were never held up, you know, because only two-wheel drive or something, but we never got held up at all. Not that we needed a great deal. If we got bogged down, we got a winch on the front of the vehicles, we could have winched ourselves out, you know.
And you're still fighting and moving through this terrain and weather.
Going north and north and north. We never got any further than, I don't know, probably 10 miles north of the River Volturno, because, as history will tell you, the 7th Armoured Division stay in Italy. Well, we went, was it the 9th of September or something, the invasion? And I remember distinctly being on the troop ship on the way back to England on Christmas Day. So that will tell you how, you know. But in the meantime, you say, well, that was quite another time. Yes, but we handed over all our equipment to the Canadians shortly after we did the Julie Andrews, you know. And we went back to the Sorrento area, Piano di Sorrento, where we just polished ourselves up, waiting for the convoy to assemble in Naples Harbour. And whilst we were waiting, we enjoyed a packaged holiday, trips into Naples. Not that that was, fair enough, but a trip to Pompeii.
Did you know you were going back to England?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
That must have uplifted you a bit.
Oh, yeah. In fact, that deal with the singing effort, the rumours had been rife then. And that's where I was leading up to, actually, is that the captain said, have you given your chocolate ration to the midman, And I said, yes, okay. She reminds me so much of the little French lassie. Must be that age now. And I happened to say to him, when I met that little French lassie, I said, we were on the way back to Blighty. And I said, he didn't answer that. I went to say to her, hello, something's true about these rumours. And sure enough, we went back there. We even had a day trip over to the Isle of Capri, courtesy of the Royal Navy, of course, and Gracie Field's house and what have
you. Have you suffered much in the Italian campaign to date?
Oh, no. I can say without tempting Providence too much, because I'm not there now, but no, it was, to me, it was an experience. Rather than a good experience, rather than a bad experience. But,
when did you return to England?
Well, as I say, we're on the boat at Christmas Day, leaving Naples. The reason I know that we were on the boat at Christmas Day, because Christmas Day was like any other day, just on the boat, was one of the wags in our battalion had written new words to Lily Marlene, and it says from the Bay of Naples over to Iran, and I forget now, but drinking our concessionary booze for Christmas Day, that's how I know, anyway, now I did say Iran, yes. They did say it was because of rough seas, what have you, but we put into Iran. And a US Navy boat come alongside us. And then the boy blinked their eyes. The whole crew of Navy, US Navy, was on board here and there. And one bloke was drinking concessionary booze, I suppose, from his enamel mug, which he painted, it was quite normal, anyway, which he painted on Citroën, LMN, Marathon, Naples, something like that. And this American bloke said, geez, God, he said, well, that's some warm idea you've got there, And the bloke said, oh, I wouldn't part with this for £1,000. And he said, I'll give you $10 for it. Done. We sold everyone that had it. We were thinking mad things like going to the ship's carpenters, have you got any dry paint so we can paint? But we said, oh, by the way, here's a naughty thing. I've never told this to anyone, not even the wife. It comes out now because I'm telling you the truth as far as I know. I had a German Luger. I said, I must get this home. And one time when in Italy there, we were billeted for a while in a fruit, a peach tinny factory. So I had loads of these tins, and so I carefully cut the tin in half, big, like a 3-pound or 4-pound tin, cut it in half, took the label off, cut it in half, halfway down, carefully, put the lure with racks and all that in, soldered the tin back up, and put the label back on, and put that in the pack, and I was going to take that home with me. I don't know that I got through the I think I would have got through the customs, obviously, but now I know how stupid I was, but nevertheless, that's what I was going to do. However, I didn't have a mum with all the this written on, and I didn't know what... Oh, by the way, we sold our... We've been issued with the African Campaign Medal Ribbon, and we kidded the youngsters that only our units got these, are special for a special concert, of course, it's, you know, wartime, you can't see them all. And that's it. Oh, and I think we sold them for about $50 each or so. It was great. But I had this little guy. Sold me a little bit as well.
Was it an uneventful journey back home?
No, it's quite a... Yes, from your point of view, but from our point of view, it was a most eventful one. But anyway, whilst we were in Iran, have you ever known a soldier looking forward to route march? Our entire battalion used to. Every day, we would be put ashore, just no equipment in there, put ashore, and a nice angle for about 3 miles and 3 miles back, and whatever, you stretch our legs. We used to look forward, and we were there about 3 days, and we used to look forward to that. That's something unusual, it's going to get forward to the route march. But anyway, we get back out to sea through the Gibraltar Strait, which we passed in the night, by the way. It was a big disappointment. I would like to have seen it. With me, navigation, I realised that we were zigzagging an awful lot. That North Star was one position, and about 4 or 5 hours later, it was in the next position, Florida, and we were going westward, of course. Now, life on board a troop ship, it was a troop ship. Now,
do you remember its name?
No, we're not. But of course, the whole of the 7th Army was going home, with, of course, big Navy escort. And ordinary, in peacetime, a troop ship is overcrowded. In wartime, it's doubled up. When our hammocks were laid out, hung up from the ceiling, some on the mess tables and floor covered with the rest and things like that was our mess deck. You know, anyway, you could appreciate the fact that the officer in charge of troops would have us doing lifeboat drill. Oh dear me. And of course you can imagine gloomy night. We realised that it needed doing, but nevertheless, soldiers will be soldiers in bloody lifeboat. And we amble up and get to the stations and, you know, muck around and what have you. And the tannery would crackle and say, You realise that this ship could have been sunk 3 times over before you got your lazy south to lifeboat station. Don't you people know there's a war on the air? Get out of here. And by the way, these drills were always instigated by the various red caps blowing whistles around the place. The claxon, we were told, was never ever used except for the real thing. One day the claxon blew. I'm not kidding you. You couldn't, if you can blink, cut that in half 4 or 5 times, and that was the amount of time required for us to get from where we were, all present and correct, and standing correct at our various lifeboat stations, and noticing for the very first time how little, how small those lifeboats were. And then we stood for it. It was a long time before the time of travel, and without any word of explanation, you know, stand down. Oh, well, I mean, we knew it was, well, we proved it all well, there you are, normal life drills. You can see how fast we can move, great, that's it, you know. Oh no, old ready boy there, he got something else up his sleeve. His sleeve. I suppose he did that, but effort to see if we could move, so that he introduced his next stage in life drill, and that was to simulate the ship that had been hit by bombs. There's a bomb hole here, and there's a bomb hole there, and there's red caps put there. You see, they said, oh, you can't come this way, you've got to go around the other way and get up that way, you know. Well, we just keepers in there. One of them, Alison, Bobby, and he just ignored the red cap and got under the tape that was going and walked across, you see. And of course, you can imagine if he didn't touch him more than once. And the story goes that at orders next morning, the officer in charge of troops, you know, "And what have you to say for yourself?" You know, "Well, sir, I used my initiative and I looked round for a plank and I placed that over the bomb hole." "Oh, that's a likely story, and where do you think you'd get such a plank?" "The same place you got your bloody bomb hole from, sir." I don't know whether that's a true story, but it fitted, you know, it fitted.
When did you arrive back in England and where?
Wait a minute. We had water coming. We ran into the worst storm that the Atlantic had known for many years. And of course, none of us were sailors, so we were battened down between decks. And all I can say is that we were battened down in a vomit swimming deck. Oh, dear. There was one upturn to all this, and that was the calling of the ship's crew that in such dreadful weather, then submarines couldn't operate. So that was what, you know, that was one good thing as well. Well, the weather did moderate, and I cannot remember any more stupid lifeboat rules. I think he knocked up that end. And we put into the Clyde, Glasgow. But of course, I'm forgetting about the sting in the tail of this seafaring now. I was down the lower decks at the time, but some of us were looking over the starboard rail, eyes glued on another hazy black streak on stretching across the starboard horizon, which the crew said was the Northern Ireland coast. Of course, Northern Ireland. It's our first 10 years look at the UK after that. Just short of 3.5 years away from it. And as I say, I was down on the deck, below decks at the time, when a catastrophic explosion, you've no idea. I'm convinced that the sides of that ship came in, hit each other, and went back out again. And there was another one, and another. And you can guess, pandemonium was just about to break out when Matey Boy's voice comes on the tannoy saying, "Oh, our naval friends are dropping depth charges just in case." The just in case business, we learned after the crew afterwards, was Jerry. Submarines had a habit of lying doggo alongside known sunken wrecks, so that any underwater, what do you call it, bing, they would say, "Oh yes, that's a wreck." So just in case there was one, all wrecks were depth charged. But my goodness me, I think I've got an idea what it must be like to be in a submarine being depth charged. I mean, we were a quarter of a mile away from this. It's market, you know. And old Matey Boy, he had the last say, as it were. But anyway, we did put into the Clyde, and we died at Glasgow, which of course is where we left. Not we, the tanks and lorries left. 3.5 years.
Was there a reception for you on the quayside?
Nope. Of course, wartime, you can't have no headlines in the papers, nothing. We were sitting, and for the first time we were allowed to open our portables, what have you. The quayside was up here above us, you know. And that slowly, that quayside came down to about a foot below, hunting there. That's the length of time where, but of course, there was a customs on board. And when he came down, anything to declare? And he waited. one chapter said, I've got 4 pounds of tobacco weight. He said, you said four, this is the customer, he said, 4 ounces? No, sir, 4 pounds in weight. Yes, he said, I heard you the first time. You don't pay any duty on 4 ounces of tobacco and put a choke across on one of the doors, and off he went. Now, apparently, he went through the office of packing with a fine tooth comb. But, you know, mind you, what we were all loaded down with was oranges. We carefully picked the best, you know, and wrapped them up in whatever tissue paper we get. And that was the bulk of our. I certainly had a few cigarettes and what have you, but that was the end of there. But anyway, I think we must have walked 5 paces, I think, off the gangplank into the train. And we were crushed in at the on board ship. In fact, nothing compartment. Was it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5? There's 10 in the compartment. I think we had 20 in the compartment. I don't know. But and of course, war time travel. And instead of going straight down the country, we came down and shot off, and we actually came through Newcastle Central Station. Now, for me, that was absolutely magnificent, you know. So it actually stopped in Newcastle Central Station, and it seemed to be teeming with females. So I didn't need to be a male inside, you know, lady porters and wafts and man girls and everything like that. Now, I don't know who started this, but it quickly got on, one chap got one of the best oranges, you know, and he said, yeah, what an orange, last thing you know, I said, oh, we haven't seen an orange for, about 2.5 years, you know. Yeah, that's as much. We haven't tasted an English girl's kiss for 3.5 years. You're not getting this one out of so. We got rid of quite a few of our officers, oranges, and we got quite a number of kisses. And it was a marvellous welcome home to me, actually. You know, anyway, we moved off, the train moved off again. I don't know where the devil it went, but it was early morning when we set off. Was it? No, wait a minute. I think it was in the morning, probably. Getting on to lunchtime. And we were on that train one night, but when we got to Fakenham Camp in Suffolk, north of the border, not very far from Mildenhall, it was just getting dark. Now imagine the scene. Missing huts, right, that hadn't been occupied much, a great deal, anything like that. One very old grey lance corporal in charge, telling us what to do, get your lot, put your blackouts before you put the light on, and there was only two, I think, 40 watt bulbs. And you've got a week's ration of coal there, well, you've got to put it in your pocket, you know, and a tiny little. We had a. Instead of undressing, we got dressed to go to bed, and even so, the breaths were steaming, getting it. But outside, nothing but slush, things like that. What a dreadful, end to a whole journey. It was, we were depressed, honestly. Next morning couldn't have been different, more different. It was a bright, sunny morning, and in the night there'd been a fair amount of snow. We went to breakfast, and we were told at breakfast the rest of the day was your own, do what you will, within reason, that's it. Well, most of the lads made for Milton Hall. I was Sean, I thought, shall I or shall I, you know, in East Anglia, pretty typical of the group. Oh, a small country town after Mansfield. But after being with all the humanity, I made for the countryside. And you know, the sun shining on the snow, it was even more dazzling than the blinking western desert or anything like that. And I wasn't too sure that I'd chosen the right thing, but anyway, there was a band of trees about 2 fields away. I'll make for that. And I made for it, and apparently it was a sort of very thick border to a sort of formal park or something. And I got there, and of course you can imagine there's not a great deal of shade there because there's no leaves on the trees or what have you. And it was there that I heard a vixen fox barking. And that took me right away back to France, which wasn't a vixen, but this was a vixen fox. There's no argument about that. And was it, you know? Anyway, I started looking around for a footprints and what have you in the snow today. And when I was looking over, by the southern aspect on the lee side of this crevice in the park, there was a bunch of snowdrops. You know, I'd seen the flowers in the desert and things like that, but to me that was the first bunch of flowers, you know, back in England.
And you must have felt the cold after.
Oh yes, I've got two lots of everything on, and put 2 lots of overcoat on. Oh yes.
Did you get leave immediately?
Oh no, it was I think 2 days afterwards, you know. But there, I began to feel strange and rotten somehow, you know. And it was there that the memory, what memory I've got and still got, of that journey across the desert, up to Shell Hitting, and then all bits and pieces of in the CCS and in the hospital here. So they came back to me, you know. And I thought, what about the other ones that hadn't come? And I felt really sad about it all. Anyway, never mind. There was the old lovely bunch of.
So you were only in the camp, you say, a couple of days, and you were sent on leave, which you would expect to be.
Oh, yes.
And coming home as 7th Armoured Division, what's well known by then? Was it? Did it have its name?
Quite well, but of course, no one knew what they were in England. And the other thing which was given to us on the, you know, we were given our own Africa Car, the Star ribbon, and we were the second issue to it, we had to pay for it. No, and of course, we were given the Desert Rat insignia for our left sleeve, left again. Mr. Torres's left sleeve. And even then, I didn't realise that 7th Armoured Division was known so well with the civilian population because I was a bit of a stupid idiot. I thought, right, when I got home, 3 weeks leave, by the way, when I got home, which, by the way, was a while after, my wife was working and her war work was in the laboratories of the British Thompson Houston, which had turned an aircraft during the war, at Rugby. So I went over to Rugby, I sort of stayed there again, and then went up, came up north and had a holiday, meeting in the north. But immediately I got home, up here, I've worn these bloody things for the last 3.5 years, I'm getting rid of them, I go to the cities. I still don't know whether that was an offence at all, John. But anyway, to hell with it. Kept me army book, you know, pay book and that with me, because there's no identification about otherwise. And I should have been warned about getting back in the uniform again. On an occasion, I went to Hartlepool to see Royal Relations there. And when I came away, it was just obviously on 5 o'clock. But when I got to the station, the bus station, it was empty. You know, I said, okay, there's a big bus coming. In the meantime, the steelworks, I suppose, had come out, and suddenly they were all there, all getting on the bus came, all getting on ahead of me. Said, hey, wait a minute, you know. And the conductor said, stand back there. I said, but I said, I'm a soldier on leave. Blah, blah, you know. I said, I'm a desert rat. Blah, you know. So I brought my pay book out, and my wife brought one of the photographs I sent over. And it was then that the conductor says, right, we've got a desert rat here, lads. Anyone care to give that seat up to them? I could have had a ticket of the bus.